Okay, let's begin with this. That Atlanta Housing Council report and the six areas designated for BRAC expansion. I guess I was curious, first of all, why the BRAC leadership would designate areas rather than just try and expand to what areas were possible.
We must go back to 46, 45. Yeah. There were the Cuba plan, mm-hmm. marching up and down Hutter Street, Chestnut Street, harassing blacks. Mm-hmm. There was a hate organization called the Colombians, mm-hmm. dynamiting homes of blacks who had moved into the Kennedy Jet Fox area, census tracts 8 and 7, that's northwest Atlanta, up there. So the blacks got together under the leadership of the late W.H. Aiken, a contractor, very wealthy contractor, and we formed the Atlanta Housing Council. We met weekly at the offices, his offices in the Rucker Building, the corner of Piedmont and Auburn Avenue.
Well, yeah, that's the one that they're discussing.
Right. That was his office. To find a solution to the problems of blacks and housing. Veterans were coming back, housing was being built for whites, very, very little was being done for blacks. So we decided, better part of wisdom, to find areas that blacks could move into peaceably. Mm-hmm. So we said, the council designated these six expansion areas around this city, mostly outside of the old city limits of Atlanta, which at that time had approximately 27 square miles of ground. We recognized that in 46, 47, 48, one official of Georgia Power Company had built Oglethorpe Apartments near Oglethorpe University, the 608 rental unit for veterans, and W.H. Aiken had to, or finally got 24 units of section 608 units.
Yeah.
Now, which is now occupied by Morris Brown College at the corner of Walnut, Vine, and MLK. So there was a tremendous imbalance of housing made available to blacks.
Okay.
About 1,000 units, I forget the guy's name, who built those Oglethorpe apartments.
So really, you were trying to find housing then that you could move into without any kind of violence erupting.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because the town was about to explode.
Yeah, sorry for that. Yeah.
And at the same time that we designated these areas, we said to the city of Harlem, here are safe areas that blacks who own land, and many of them, should be able to develop housing for blacks or Negroes at that particular time. The city fathers and the leaders of Harlem bought the idea.
This is the Metropolitan Planning Council, I guess, became
firmly fixed in the minds of the people at that time that these were areas, safe areas, that blacks could move in. At the same time, the Housing Council found 52 acres of land owned by the county, Fulton County, at the corner, the northwest corner of West Lake and Simpson, which is now occupied by Allen Temple AME Church. We, at the Urban League and the council, sought to acquire that 52-acre tract from the county and build housing. We had approximately 100 or more veterans attending meetings is the offices of Vera LeMay and the Herndon Building in an effort to try to acquire that land. That land was subsequently sold by the county to another developer, White, who in turn later sold it to a black developer by the name of Wolf, contractor, who built houses in that area. But that happened much later, somewhere between 50 and 55, that area developed. No sooner than we had gotten the plan, this plan of council, fixed in the minds of the city fathers and blacks, we at the Urban League made another land ownership analysis of all of the land between Bankhead Avenue and the Fulton County line on the south. We have a map approximately 20 by 30 feet, and we knew the names, addresses of every landowner in that particular area. And we proceeded at that point to appoint the real estate brokers and black financiers, professionals, to buy land in that area. And one of the successful, or some of the successful developments that occurred in that area were the Chenault, Robert and Ben Chenault, bought 128 acres of land west of Southwest Community Hospital, which is down there very quietly. Another tract of land was acquired by a 52-acre tract of land was acquired by Dr. J.B. Harris on Peyton Road. The development at the same time, another development was taking place, namely Q.B. Williamson, Q.B. Williamson, L.D. Milton, W.S. Cannon, at all brought 200 acre tract of land, which is now known as Kessel Farm. So while the was kind of a, what was developing at that time was kind of a what was developing at that time was kind of a leapfrog Pensum. We were hemmed in.
Yeah, what I could gather from what
we were hemmed in, because shortly after World War II, the late Dr. R.A. Billings wanted to build a home at the corner of Chickamauga and MLK, just before you get to Mosley Park, coming this way.
Okay.
And the whites objected, because the whites lived in that part of the southwest part of the city. So we recognized that we were fast becoming boxed in. So what we did, we jumped over.
Yeah.
It was a leapfrog process. We went beyond. We found this area where I now live.
This was white too?
No, this was vacant land.
Oh, okay.
All this was vacant. See, the whites had lived, you know where you came under I-20 there?
Yeah.
That was a white church there. The whites then sold that church to Union Baptist Church,
flat,
mm-hmm.
and went to the intersection of Sewell and Lyndhurst and built a huge, beautiful church. And they said, we're away from the niggers at last. But little did they realize that we had gone beyond Sewell. Southwest Hospital bought the 128 acres. See, the Chalons had.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Harris had bought land on Peyton Road. Okay? The black businessmen bought Preston Forest land. Bell Realty Company bought land on in Crestwood Forest area.
Mm-hmm.
So the whites then were, these whites are down here, but in Moser Park area, mm-hmm. were pocketed.
Okay.
And we had jumped over, bought land. Nobody can stop you from buying land. And one of the key persons in this was Morris Abram.
Yeah, that just becomes too hard to catch him around.
The land came into a white real estate firm,
mm-hmm.
Adam Cates.
Yeah, that's the round.
Right. Morris was a person who then in turn deeded the land to the Chenaults, who paid $30,000 for the 128 acres.
So he was the intermediary?
He was the intermediary. Yeah. J.B. Harris paid $6,000 for the 52 acres on Peyton Road.
Hmm.
What the black businessmen paid for the land on Peyton Forest, I don't know, but Q.B. Williamson would have to tell you, to give you that story.
Yeah, I'll wait a few weeks before I can.
Sure.
Yeah. In terms of the black community being hemmed in, why would the white government particularly care about that? I mean, they didn't seem to care very much about anything else. Why would they?
Well, we determined that our future would not be determined by them, yeah. by whites. We found land south of the federal penitentiary,
mm-hmm.
and got a development. There was a man down there who developed his property. We went to Doraville, found Sally Parsons,
mm-hmm.
who lived on the north side of Industrial Boulevard. And blacks had lived on the site where General Motors plant is now. General Motors at Doraville. Okay? When the officials of General Motors came into the city of Atlanta and said they wanted to build a plant, Scott Candler said, good, you'll condemn the houses of the niggers. General Motors said, no, you don't do business like that. We will buy their land, we'll cross the street to where Sally Parsons lived, who had lots of land,
yeah.
and relocate, sell the blacks the land, and help them to build the houses.
I didn't know the corporation was so decent.
General Motors would did that.
That's interesting. That's
Now that's a part of it, and I'm glad you're taping this, because I may not live long enough to get this out on tape.
Well, this is something I never came across
right.
at all. That's right.
And the reason that General Motors wanted to put the plant where it is now located, they was on solid rock, and they had to have solid rock for their stamping machines,
oh, yes.
to stamp the bodies. So, secondly, it was at the railroad, and this is where that's the history of General Motors plant at Doraville.
And I guess once General Motors says something, nobody else complains. I mean,
Scott Candler said, oh yes,
yeah.
that is the way we do business down here. We just moved the niggas.
Yeah.
But General Motors said no. Another area in the expansion area was Margaret Mitchell Drive.
Mm-hmm.
The highway split that community, little black community. And we tried our best. It was called Old Bolton Road at that time. And we tried our best to get the blacks to improve the housing, get water and sewer and decent sanitary facilities, because the whites were moving and surrounding.
Mm-hmm.
And one of my good friends, George Goodwin, you may know George Goodwin.
Mm-hmm.
George Goodwin is a very, very fine person. He would live, he was a newspaper man, and now with a firm, a Bell and Stanton, I believe, downtown, George L. Goodwin, a person you should talk to.
And he's with,
Sure.
Hi, David.
Now, let's see, George Goodwin is with Kuna.
He was a public relations firm. Yeah. It was Bell and Stanton, and it was Bell and Stanton, it may have been something else. This is George L. Goodwin.
Okay. And what was his actual role then?
George was a member of a church on Moores Mill Road.
Mm-hmm.
And one Saturday afternoon, he asked me to come up and meet with the people up there at the church to solicit their assistance in trying to improve the conditions of blacks in that area. He was a former board member of the Urban League and a longtime friend of blacks, and for good in the city. Just a very decent guy.
He was right.
Yes, sir. He's right.
Okay. Speak to him. Mm-hmm. In terms of these six or so black expansion areas now, I take it that Hartsfield had something to do with allowing this to happen or approving it.
Hartsfield had nothing to do with it.
Okay, this was done all beyond the city government then?
This was done by private council.
Okay.
We did this.
Okay.
And what made all of this work was that in about 1949-50, we formed what was called, the two things happened. We formed the Negro Voters League. Blacks, Republicans, Black Democrats came together. Became a very powerful entity.
That was the Walden Dogs.
Right. Secondly, we formed the All Citizens Registration Committee. And what we did, Ray Hamilton, Jake Henderson, the late C.A. Baco, and myself, sat down in Mr. Henderson's apartment when he was manager of Radiant of the housing project over here on Chestnut Street, and we discussed the formation.
Okay.
And we decided that we would organize a campaign to increase voter registration. My particular role was to lay out the city by census tracts, by blocks, and get enumerations for every block in the city. We called the people together and told them what we were going to do. And we had census tract captains and block workers. And in 6 weeks, we put 25,000 blacks on the book, approximately 25,000.
Okay, this is what I take it made Hartsfield sit up and take notice.
Oh, sure. I'd made it.
Yeah.
Because as I understand it, during his very first administration, and I was in service at that time, that he said, well, I can't do anything because you ain't got the vote. Okay, we got the vote. Right. And he did.
Because then there was the hiring of black police.
That didn't come until much later.
Okay, but that was, I guess, related to the...
Oh, sure. Not only that, but we were able to loosen money from white institutions.
Oh, because of the voting. What sort of money and for what?
For housing. I'll give you an example of the clout that we had at that particular time. I read that Connecticut General Life Insurance Company was making residential loans in the city of Atlanta.
Mm-hmm.
And I have correspondence somewhere in here. I wrote a letter to the president of Connecticut General and asked why, or if he would make loans to Negroes at that time. I don't recall as to whether or not I got a reply, but I did get a call from the late, the person whose name, the housing project over here on Ashford Street was named after. He was connected with Adam Cates. John O'Childs. John O'Childs called me at the Urban League and said, "Bob, I understand that you need some money from Connecticut General. Why didn't you tell me that you wanted money?" "Mr. Childs, I didn't know that you were the correspondent for Connecticut General. How much money do you want?" "I want two loans of $25,000 each, namely for the late H.M. Jackson, the housing official, and James Gilbert, the housing. Those two loans remain."
And to be used for black housing? Mortgages?
Mortgages, yeah.
How about the banks in town? How about the trust company and those?
Well, the trust company, you see, banks don't really make it.
Yeah.
But I can say this in favor of Atlanta Federal, which is now Georgia Federal. W.O. Duval had loaned or made many mortgages to Aiken, W.H. Aiken,
yeah,
for loans.
Fire?
Oh, yes.
Fire.
That's right.
Okay. Just to sort of summing up that part, in terms of black leaders therefore pushing for certain areas, these are the areas they felt they could get without violence, and these were the areas that the black community really wanted.
Blacks owned the land.
Okay. Okay. Well, that's important in terms of what blacks are doing for themselves.
And the other thing that we failed with, I failed, and I've part of this was a great deal of regret. I failed to show blacks. I kept saying it. I said, "You ought to, now that we've gotten these areas designated and blacks are beginning to build and buy houses and develop it, you should be looking at the area between I-85, I-75, and Five Points."
Yeah.
I call that the Golden Triangle. And every now and then I run across the old timer who said, "I wish I had listened." They listened to this area,
yeah,
and the other areas, but I could not get them to go into that area. They would have been blacks would have been multimillionaires.
Oh, sure. The land at that time was just, I guess it was cheap compared to what it became.
For sure.
Okay, let me mention a few other things. I came across a few agreements between the Empire Real Estate Board and the city on racial transition in certain Southwest neighborhoods. In other words, agreements between Empire and the city in 1952, for example, to a boundary line for black expansion at the northern part of Westview Drive, which is pretty close to here. And I was curious about why blacks would accept that type of boundary line with the city stepping in as an intermediary. And
violence.
Again, violence. Yeah. Okay. Same thing with agreements with the Westside Mutual Development Corporation.
Violence.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I guess that would be related to why blacks who had bought homes and were being harassed would agree to sell them back to whites and get out of that neighborhood. Because I came across that a few times also.
Yeah. What happened over here in the Moser Park area? You see, Ron, this area from Anderson Avenue was all vacant,
mm-hmm,
all vacant land. we found the owners. Instead of trying to get blacks to, with money to buy the land, we encouraged the blacks who owned the land across the street and beyond the Chenaults to develop it. We got Knox Corporation. At that time, it's an interesting sideline here. Tom Cousins came to our office and said, I represent Knox Corporation. Can we got anything we can of interest to us? I said, yes. Down the road here, about three blocks, there are 67 houses that the Chenaults entered into contract with Knox Corporation.
With Cousins.
With Tom Cousins.
Now, what was his interest in that besides making money?
He was employed by Knox Corporation. That's right.
Now, in other words, the Knox Corporation, which what is here, is that located?
No, it was located in Thompson, Georgia.
Okay. A white firm?
White firm.
And they were
making three fab houses.
So they started just as a profit owner, that's it.
Of course. Yeah. What they did was, the Chenaults owned the land. The Knox Corporation came in, got the streets paved, the water, the sewer, and everything. The Chenaults went to the closing of the loan when the houses were sold and picked up $1,666 per lot and hadn't done anything. And Tom Cousins, that was his beginning.
I didn't realize he was involved in that. That's interesting too. Yeah.
Tom will tell you today that if you talk with him, we became very good friends after that. And I kept saying to him, Tom, you got to come downtown. You got to come downtown. But Bob, I am. I said, now, the Georgia Tech, or the Metropolitan Planning Council, and Georgia Tech students have made a study of the hole in Atlanta's heart.
Mm-hmm.
I said, all this land down here over the railroad. Why don't you come on down there and do something about it? And Tom would, if you talk to me, tell you that probably I had something to do with his development downtown today. Mm-hmm. We've been friends for a long, long time.
Well, I can see if it goes back to that period, yeah. Let's see, also came across a 1954 agreement on the Kaya Heights area regarding an access road being used as a dividing line. And it seems to be one of a number of cases of highways being used as dividing lines, boundary lines. And again, was it acceptable for the black community to accept the
Kaya Heights area?
Yeah.
I don't recall which.
Well, it's a 1954 agreement, but it's the same type of agreement we're using I-20 as a boundary line too, going into the Adamsville area. You know, what I'm finding out, I've gone through the Hartsfield papers and the Atlanta City planning papers, and what I could gather was that some roads were actually put in certain directions and moved around in certain directions simply to provide the buffer that they needed between the black and white communities.
In the Collier Heights area?
Yeah, and in the Adamsville area. Yeah, in Adamsville, the route of the West Expressway, which would be this road, was used as a boundary line, according to the City Planning Bureau report. It was actually, I don't know how much this was known to the black community, but certainly the City Planning Board was using that road specifically as a dividing line.
The river, the circular road around the city?
Yeah. Well, I-20, in this case I-20, the West Expressway.
No. I-20 was scheduled to come on this side of the railroad track.
Mm-hmm.
We got it moved to the other side of the railroad.
Okay, what?
It would have destroyed all of these houses. It would have been much more expensive to put the highway through here.
Okay, well, how about as a dividing line?
You know, there's no dividing line because this was all black.
Yeah. Okay, I'll have to recheck that then. Again, I came across a lot of access roads being talked about as a dividing line. This is from the Hartsfield papers, but as he was writing to people saying, we have to hurry up and finish the so-so access road because the people, the white people in the area are getting nervous, and we have to build that road to keep them feeling secure, because the black community is getting crooked.
There weren't any roads built. There weren't any roads built. The nearest thing that, one of the damnable things that Hartsfield and the Fulton County Commissioner did, when Dr. Harris bought the 52 acres of land on Peyton Road, the county commissioners and the city of Atlanta did the following. They ran a spur line from this railroad across MLK to make an industrial site to block the westward expansion. But hell, we were much beyond that at that time.
So what was the purpose of that then?
The purpose of it, he wanted to block the westward expansion of blacks going into Audubon Forest, way down on Cascade,
right,
and that fine area down there. But he did not know that blacks had bought the 128 acres. We had formed a corporation called Western Land Incorporated and bought 85 acres on the east side of Fairburn Road across just below Southwest Hospital.
Mm.
That corporation was headed by Walden, myself, Dr. J.B. Harris, and Morris Aker. We formed that corporation, bought that 85 acres for $30,000. And in 1950, we sold it in about 1962 for $85,000.
But in a sense, you were then sort of bouncing over the buffer zone.
We'd gone over.
Yeah. Yeah. Another thing that sort of relates to that, the highways being used to displace blacks, and this is something else I came across, that the highway through the city, the North-South Highway, was planned with the idea of cutting through black neighborhoods, and this I mean particularly 7585, cutting through Auburn Avenue, that the highway was shifted from a route west of the business area. It was supposed to be originally elevated over the railroad gulch, and was switched to the eastern route to cut through and displace blacks in that Auburn Avenue area. And this was done apparently at the assistance of city leaders.
Well,
did you come across anything like that as well?
Well, there was a planner by the name of Lochner.
Yeah, his highway study, I've seen.
The Lochner plan called for a highway to go through the Line of Life building.
Mm-hmm.
And they ran into a bottleneck because they would have gone right through Greater Hospital.
Yeah.
Okay?
Right.
So they moved the road, downtown connector, to its present location, and you notice that it is, you come in to Atlanta from the north, and you got a kind of a curve there.
Right, you swing around east.
That's right.
Right.
This swung around the black community, because we had the power at that time to influence the location of the road.
Oh, you do.
But they wanted to go right straight through the Line of Life building, which in turn would have gone straight through Greater Hospital.
Uh-huh.
And that would have been too expensive.
Now how about going over the railroad gulch though? That would have been a better.
The railroad gulch here.
Yes. Yeah.
That would have been expensive too, but not nearly as expensive as it would where they're now located, the road.
Yeah, because didn't at the same time cut through through Auburn Avenue, which was certainly, it cut through that section.
It cut over Auburn Avenue, but
yeah.
That highway didn't displace too many people.
Yeah.
What displaced blacks in that area was urban renewal.
Yeah. Okay.
And the interesting thing there on that urban renewal thing, there were three urban renewal projects. The Ralston Washington Street project,
mm-hmm,
the Auburn Avenue project. Let's see what the hell was it over there. I don't recall the third one that was approved at that time. But we at the Urban League said, well, if you want to displace these people, you've got to have some place to put them.
But
we said that the area of Rockdale Park,
mm-hmm,
will be a relocation resource area.
Mm.
And the Federal Pen area.
Mm.
At the same time, the Atlanta Housing Authority had an allocation to build 2,000 public housing units. And one of the executives, or Mr. Farrell, I think his name was, wanted to put all 2,000 of them on in South Atlanta, where we had built High Point Apartments.
Oh yeah.
And we said no, put 1,000 down there and put the other 1,000 out in Rockdale Park.
And they agreed to that?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, two things that relate to what you just brought up. First of all, the use of public housing as buffers, and I came across, again, the use of Joel Chandler Harris Homes, which started out as a white project.
Yes.
As a buffer. Was that true? Was it used?
True.
Okay. And also the use of public housing to move the black population to the west side. And I came across a number of things like that, that there seemed to be almost a set plan to just uproot the black community out of the central area and move it to the west side during the 50s. Now, I don't know what the black community's response to that was. I got a few quotes saying they were sort of bitter that no public housing was built up on the north side. Everything was being shifted over to the west side and southwest area.
There wasn't any vacant land in northeast Atlanta to build public housing, okay?
Yeah.
Except the Atlanta Housing Authority wanted to acquire a site, a tract of land near the old Eggleston Hospital.
Yeah, I heard about that.
And the Baptist minister, what is that Baptist name? Got up in City Hall and prayed a long prayer. Oh, what is that guy's name? He may be dead or very, very aged now. One prominent Baptist minister.
I think I've come across his name too, I don't remember him.
That we don't want this project over in northeast Atlanta. At the same time, the city of Atlanta was about to have a bond referendum to widen North Avenue,
mm-hmm.
which at that time dead ended at Sears Roebuck.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we said, okay, we don't approve, we won't go along with it because we want North Avenue open all the way.
Yeah.
And there was a white guy at the hall, City Hall, named Joe. And I forget his first name, but he named Escape Me. And the Uptown Improvement Association.
Mm-hmm.
Fought to keep North Avenue from being widened beyond Sears Roebuck.
Okay.
And we said, if you do, you won't pass the bond program.
Now, to widen it past Sears Roebuck would have meant what now?
Opening it up all the way east.
Okay.
Because you go down to the end of that street. Where Sears Roebuck is. Calling the Ponce de Leon at some street. And we said that North Avenue must be widened and all the way through. Because blacks had moved, the whites didn't want blacks to cross North Avenue and Ponce de Leon.
Mm-hmm.
So they wanted to keep North Avenue closed.
Yeah. I also came across some information that there was an effort to rezone North Avenue for commercial purposes, as again, acting as a commercial buffer.
That's right. That is true.
Yeah.
They tried all of that.
Okay. Let's see. Okay. There's also, again, as buffers, from what I've read, the purpose of the stadium where it was put, the purpose of the civic center in terms of where it was put. Were they located there again to displace the black community on the south side and to act as buffers between the black community and the business area?
No, the stadium was in an urban renewal area.
Yeah.
And Ivan Allen got the stadium there. Even when he didn't have title to the land, he was hell bent on having the stadium and a baseball team there. So he acted. And this was no effort to displace black blacks. It was already an urban renewal area.
Okay. And the Civic Center, same thing?
Civic Center.
Buttermilk Bottom area?
Buttermilk Bottom area was an urban renewal area too.
Okay. Now, there's no reason why federal projects couldn't be put in those urban renewal areas.
That's right. Blacks could have bought land and developed the same damn thing.
That's right. Well, the land could have been developed for new housing rather than a stadium.
Yes. Yeah. But at the same time, the stadium was, to my way of thinking, is the best place for it. I'm not too consoled that the housing should be down there, because it was a horrible hellhole when they got to clean that area out, and we needed a stadium.
But you also needed housing.
Yes, but we were making plans for housing. We had the 221 housing. We had the private enterprise housing, 608. We had 203 housing.
Yeah.
Blacks were building all over the city of Atlanta, moving these blacks out. And what I guess I'm saying is that somebody coming in, looking at this as if to say, well, the cities did this, the whites did it, but blacks determined to a very great extent their own future.
And well, that's probably what I wanted to hear. And
right.
I've gotten, the white part is really written up in a lot of books. I don't get the black part of it really very often.
We determined where we wanted to live to a very great extent.
Mm-hmm. So you did have some leverage with City Hall, and your leverage was through the votes.
Through the votes.
Especially on bond voting.
That's right. Yeah. Right. Well, another example of the power of the vote, when Ivan Allen decided to run to become mayor, we had a meeting out at the home of L.B. Milton on Waterford Road. And this was initiated, I think, by Milton, Yates, Major Blake, and Grace Hamilton, and some others. Mm-hmm. I attended that meeting. And one of the things we said to him, we want Simpson Street from North Avenue, or Northside Drive,
mm-hmm.
to Ashby Street widened. Give us commitment that you will do this and we'll put you in office.
You
agree?
And it was done?
It was done.
That's the way the government works, I guess.
The county commissioners reneged on their part. The county was supposed to pick up the widening of Simpson Road from Ashby Street to Westlake.
Yeah.
To widen and straighten it out. The county commissioners failed to do this.
So the city kept its deal, but the county didn't, I guess.
That's right.
Yeah. That was another area I wanted to bring up, too. It struck me that there were certain areas where the certain areas where the city government tried to keep blacks contained in new areas by offering better city services. It seemed to me before that a lot of black areas didn't have paved streets and were poorly served by sanitation services and so on and so on. And it seemed that when the city got the Empire Real Estate Board to agree to stay in a certain area, there was now an effort made by the city to provide things like paved roads and waters and sewage and so on if the blacks agreed to a certain boundary line.
Uh-oh.
You didn't see that either? Okay.
No. No. You must realize that in subdivisions,
mm-hmm.
the developer had to pay the cost of the streets, the water, the water line. City put in the sewer lines, city put in the water line, but all of the other things were borne by the developer.
Mm-hmm.
So in Paper Forest, or Crestwood Forest, black money and entrepreneurship did all of that. Down here in Peyton and Peyton Forest, Peyton Forest, yes, Harris's,
mm-hmm.
The developer did all of that.
Okay. No help from the city, no?
Oh, yes. It got help from the city. Because once the developer was approved, the city had to go in and do these things.
Well, they didn't have to.
They didn't.
But they never did it before.
Oh, we didn't have large-scale subdivisions that before either.
Mm-hmm.
They had to put these things in. Nobody's going to, no developer or mortgager is going to put money in a subdivision on dirt roads.
Okay, agreed. But, you know, my thinking was that the city was willing to agree, also again, to certain expansion areas, with the stipulation that the blacks would stay there and they would provide them with needed.
No. We put those roads in, black money, white money put those roads in, the Peyton Forest, Crestwood Forest,
mm-hmm.
and other subdivisions. They were treated just like any other white subdivision.
Okay.
Had to do that. Because if Duval would have raised hell, Atlanta Federal would have raised hell, he would have put all his money in the subdivision with dirt roads.
Yeah, I guess he wouldn't. Right. How about... I came across some cases, for example, Westview Drive. The black community was allowed to go to about 100 yards of Westview Drive. Westview Drive was the boundary line. And from what I gather, that the 100 yards leading to Westview Drive was not paved. That was, again, the buffer. Westview Drive was a buffer, and the 100 yards of unpaved road was supposed to be a buffer also. And I got the feeling the city paved and didn't pave roads, depending on...
Westview Drive was always paved.
Mm-hmm. Well, the roads leading up to Westview Drive.
There were no roads unpaved leading into Westview Drive.
I think I read that in the article you had in the Glazer and McIntyre book. I'm not sure on that.
No roads were unpaved. The only road that was deliberately cut or unpaved was Fair Street between Chickamauga and the railroad.
Okay.
That was the only paved road. Westview Drive and was a main artery.
Mm-hmm.
It's paved all the way through ever since I've been here.
Okay, but how about, again, the roads leading up to Westview Drive?
On both sides.
Paved also?
Sure.
Okay. How about situations in which the roads would be paved leading from one black subdivision to another and in a way that...
They finally approved High Point Apartments, $55 a month. $55 a month, I'm sorry, it was then $25. And blacks moved into that apartment. Then we got the Housing Authority to build 1,000 units on the east side of the street. And that opened up that whole area. What we were doing at that time. We used government to help blacks move out of the 24 square mile, or whatever the acres were of it now, move out of this small area. Because Hartsfield, during his first administration, and prior, during his first administration, appeal to Buckhead.
Right.
Do you want the niggas to run Atlanta? You got to come into the city of Atlanta.
Yeah, I came across a lot of private papers that said just that.
That's right. You know I ain't lying.
I don't know.
So we used public housing authority. Put the project out of Rockdale Park.
Mm.
Put it down here in South Atlanta. So this helps us to get out.
Right.
While at the same time, private blacks were buying land and developing it too. So we used practically every opportunity that the instrument that we had available to us to break out, because Atlanta was in process of expanding its city limits
right.
to 118 square miles. And if we were going to get out, that was the particular time to get out.
That's right. That's right. So you don't remember anything about, again, getting back to this High Point Apartments, in terms of this highway business that was involved there, about sending a delegation to Washington to change the route of the road?
I'm not aware of that.
Okay. Okay, getting back to this outlying area business again, I came across a 1961 letter from you to Cecil Alexander on the Ben Hill section, in which apparently the FHA had approved 221 housing for whites in that area, but not for blacks. So I was curious why.
Go back to a gentleman, a retired Army man by the name of Jones. I think it was
Malcolm?
Malcolm Jones.
Yeah, he's still around.
He's still around?
Yeah.
Malcolm in the years. the city policy was X number of units for whites, X number of units for blacks. Okay? And we said, okay, what about these units? We prevailed upon the city to put 221 units on Pool Creek Road, which is down there with the Carlin Brewery. Now that area is demolished now. Prevailed upon the city to put the 221 units on Fairburn Road, west of the Harper High School. Because if we had been left to Malcolm, blacks would not have gotten any 221.
Well, he was that bad.
Yeah, I don't see he's that bad.
He was no friend.
No, we made a friend out of him.
The, apparently, you felt housing for blacks could sell in the outlying area. That was one of the points you apparently made.
Yes.
And apparently the FAH rejected outlying black housing, and particularly the race advisors, the FAH, a fellow by the name of Al Thompson, who was black, opposed outlying 221 housing for blacks. And I was curious why a black FAH official would oppose outlying projects.
Al did not oppose the projects down in Ben Hill, the 221. He did not oppose the 221 houses built on the west side of Hightower Road, mm-hmm. which at that time was outside of the city limits. Both projects were outside of the city limits. Mm-hmm. But Al had administrators, superiors, who were to some extent negative. And Al was a real friend on the inside who helped us tremendously. The FHA houses in Crestwood Forest, the FHA houses in Peyton Forest, anywhere, Al was right there assisting. Because Al was a part of the Housing Council, as was H.M. Jackson, Hubert M. Jackson, who Al was the racial relations advisor for FHA. Mm-hmm. Hubert M. Jackson was race relations advisor for PHA. Their offices were segregated. They were located in the Oddfellows Building on Auburn Avenue. They were not allowed
in the government building, this
where the rest of their counterparts were.
Yeah.
And it was not until, I forget the year, but I think it more or less was Bob Weaver became secretary and said, hell, this doesn't make sense. You go there where your other co-workers are, Al, and you go where your PHA people are.
So if he opposed outlying housing to blacks, it was simply because of pressure from his superiors.
I'm not too sure that he did, by virtue of the fact that, as I indicated, the 221 houses west of Hightower, he had to approve them, and he did approve them. He approved the 221 houses on Pool Creek. Because Al was a part and parcel of this now the Housing Council that designated the expansion area. And Pool Creek was in, at that time, I think, I'm not certain about this. Census Tract FC-20, as it was called at that time. So Al approved that. He approved the area down south of the federal penitentiary.
Okay, so he was definitely a supportive friend.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay.
I got to get me some more familiar. Could I get you some?
No, no thanks. All right.
Rick, do you want a phone bill?
Okay. Beer would be fine. Sure.
Why? Beer
would be fine.
And we were constantly searching for funds to report. Because we recognize that there's not the abuse, that there's only a certain amount of money available at any given time in the city for a multiplicity of uses.
Oh, that's true.
So we contacted the, of course, the insurance companies, labor unions, and finally we were asked by the Ford Foundation to submit. They sent two men down to the River Lake to talk to J.B. Bladen and me. He was chairman of my board at that time, to submit a proposal to the Ford Foundation that would attempt to enlarge the middle class. As you know, as a sociologist, blacks are sharply pyramided. Okay? And the Ford Foundation at that time was interested in that George Bundy was the honcho there then. A program that would enlarge this middle class so it wouldn't be so sharply pyramided. So we drafted a beautiful proposal. And sent it to the Ford Foundation, in which we asked the Ford Foundation to deposit $190-some million in black financial institutions. Monies which would be paid back to the Ford Foundation. Banks would pay it back at a specified period of time. Savings loan would pay back at a longer period of time because they would be invested in mortgages at a rate. Since put $198 million for it. I think it's $198 million. And Ford Foundation would get all of its principal back, plus 2%. Mm-hmm. The institutions would lend the money. Then the institutions and the Ford Foundation would in turn create another organization. Yeah. To the Ford Foundation. This was in about
69.
Yeah. So the Ford Foundation sent three representatives to Atlanta, namely Christopher Emmett, who now has the United Negro College Fund. The treasurer of the Ford Foundation, and two other gentlemen, the latter two had been here before to talk with us. We met at the home of J.B. Bladen. He was a CPA, one of the first black CPAs in the country, to discuss this proposal. And after a whole evening of eating and drinking, I drove them back to the hotel, and the treasurer said, "Quite a provocative idea, Mr. Thompson, but you'll have to study it." So I said, "Please do, and let us know." got back Christopher Henry, who grew up in the same town that I did in Newport, who wrote and said, "Bob, that's a hell of an idea, but it's too big." I said, "Hell, we're talking about 15, 20 million blacks in the country." And maybe 35 or 40 banks to say loan transition. They turned the idea down to our dismay. Mm-hmm. And heard it. In the meantime, Milton and I went to New York. And when the bank expense, we talked to him, pleaded a case with one of the guys who had been here. And they said, "Well, we don't have to think about it." Then I left the Urban League in 64. And this is a letter that I got from them when I reopened the case while I was with the government. Mm-hmm. March of 1969. The key paragraph that made me feel very ill.
Hmm. Well,
the Ford Foundation at the same time had lost about $100 million in an investment in Canada. Didn't get a goddamn dime back.
And then that's what we went to invest in, huh? Canada.
But we were asking, yeah, not for a gift, but just deposit.
Hmm. Well, I guess things between 62 and 69 have changed quite a bit.
The revolution.
That's right.
That's right. It changed them. When we were way ahead of their thinking, according to them at that time.
That's interesting. That's good. Let me get back to just this MARTA thing, well, not the transit thing again. Once again, let me get this clear. The transit company was willing to go only as far as the white area in this section, and wasn't serving the black community. Is that right? And then agreed to serve the black community once this area was developed more fully and the transition.
After the whites moved out.
After the whites moved out, and again, after the transition was desegregated too, I imagine.
No.
It took the whites to move out.
The whites moved out. You see, MARTA came later.
Yeah, MARTA came later, right.
Okay.
But the streetcars, I would say, then.
Yeah. The streetcars and buses.
So in other words, to avoid violence, they served only the white community after the whites moved out.
On this, I can only speak for this area.
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay. As I indicated, the bus stopped at MLK and Chapel.
Right.
And because most of the park was all white.
Yeah.
So when I built this house in 1950, we rode through this area, and my daughter could never understand why she couldn't go and move the park through. And she was becoming very, very bitter. And here I had come from the war, and I was a member of the American Veterans Committee. Mm-hmm. Very liberal, Johnny Knoxon, Lester Sells, and just a whole host of beautiful people, you know, whites we meet here and elsewhere. So she was becoming very bitter. So we decided that to overcome this bitterness and against whites, where we could undergo it, she couldn't. So we sent her to school in Massachusetts for 4 years in high school, and then made a hell of a hard, bad mistake when she got a scholarship to Cole College in Cedar Rapids, Iowa.
Far away.
And that was a hell of a hard, bad mistake. And she finally goes and says, "I hate Iowa. I hate the Midwest. I hate this. I'll quit school or else come back to Atlanta or go. I want to go back to school east," because she had gone to Stockbridge School in Massachusetts.
I saw that from Iowa.
for the soul out there. And I didn't know until I began to talk to some of my white friends. Said, Bob, why did you send her to the Mississippi of the West? I said, what?
Oh, really?
Yes, that's what they call Crow College.
I didn't know.
Two black girls with 10 whites, and they expected these two black girls to fraternize with only the blacks. But having gone to Coach Dudley School, she was not accustomed to this.
Yeah. I never heard about Crow College, you
know. If you ever have a child, don't send it to Poland.
Huh? Well, I have children, but I won't send them there.
But anyway, so the Mona thing, streetcar thing, was simply to serve the white community, not the blacks, until this area became black, so the whites in Mosley Park moved out, then they didn't have to worry about any kind of conflict on the streetcars.
Well, not on the conflict, but peace in the city. That's what Somerville was really saying. He didn't want any whites in the Mosley Park area because the blacks had to come through.
So he wanted just to keep the streetcars all white if he could.
Well, not necessarily.
Or all black if he could.
Well, don't put it exactly like that. I think what he was trying to say is, and I think I'm being kind to him now. This was the character, this was the tenor of time. This was a very volatile area, the Park area was. And anything could have happened. John Calhoun, he's about 85, 86 years old, called me one Saturday and said he wanted me to meet him at Chickamauga and Mosley Place. And the area was white at that time. When we got there, we were surrounded by whites. Mm-hmm. Very, very vociferous. Wanted to do bodily harm. Mm-hmm. So we had to back away. But gradually the whites began to say, yes, sir.
And after they sold them, the streetcars came out.
That's right.
Okay, that's, let's see what else we're going to go through there. This effort to develop integrated neighborhoods. I came across the Southwest Atlantic Alliance for Progress, which seems to be one of the few organizations in the city actually pushing for integrated neighborhoods.
Zenona Clayton. You know her?
No. What's her name?
Zenona Clayton. Very attractive, vivacious little woman, beautiful. She's connected with one of the radio stations or television stations.
She's still in the city?
Yes.
And she was head of this?
Yes, she lived down in the Southwest section, and she did her damnedest to try to stabilize the community and keep the whites from running.
Yeah, that would have been the trick, I guess.
Yes. Huh?
Now, was the city supportive in any way of integration, or were they simply pushing for separate black, separate white neighborhoods? They weren't really interested in integration.
I don't think the city was pushing in any way, either way. Blacks were doing this on their own.
Mm-hmm.
We got no help from the city. Now, Zenona, being the leader in that effort down there, can tell you more about what the city did or did not do.
Because again, the impression I got from my readings was that the city wasn't interested in integrated neighborhoods. They were interested simply in no violence. Whatever would bring about no violence, maybe, and they felt that segregation was the way to bring that about, just keep the blacks and whites separated as much as possible. I take it that's what that whole Peyton Road Wall was all about. Different area, of course.
No. Peyton Road is a part and parcel of the Southwest.
Oh, it is? Okay. So you're part of the Southwest. Okay.
A white plumber who lived on Peyton Road was in process of getting a divorce from his wife.
Mm-hmm.
And to spite her, he said he sold his property, house, to Dr. Clinton Warner.
The dentist wasn't here.
No, physician. Highly skilled. Clinton bought the house for $50,000, I think $50,000. He could have paid for it cash, but the line of life funded it.
Mm-hmm.
Then blacks began to buy the houses in Peyton, down Peyton Road.
Mm-hmm.
Not all of the whites wanted to sell. Some did, some didn't. not having money, genuine money that they had over the eyes of the whites, you know, the whites decided to sell. Plus, Allen came on the scene to help stabilize that situation. He inadvertently and ineptly put the barricade across the road. Spent all the years since the early war. Stayed up there about a day, if that long. Maybe 2 days, maybe a week, I don't know. Taken down. And the whites then began to flee.
Now, he claims he was trying to calm the whites rather than keep out the blacks. That's his justification for that.
Yeah, whatever the damn reason was.
We're stupid, nobody wanted it.
Mind you, Allen had made one other big mistake years ago. You know, to put on the blacks on South Georgia.
You know the Atlanta blacks?
All the blacks of Georgia. I don't know what actually changed Ivan. He was a very decent man. But the leadership of the latter, white leadership of the latter at that time, consisted of Woodruff, Allen, Dick Rich, President Tonkin Company, and another one, the father. I have a picture somewhere in my paper.
I guess one of the bankers must have been involved in it. Sibley or one of them?
Oh, John Sibley. Little man.
He's still alive?
Yeah. Wonderful guy. Apparently they saw the handwriting on the wall. Like with all the political power, with the money, they were making waves, decided to reverse themselves and to all change their attitude.
The self-interest?
I don't know, the self-interest. Or whatever. I say self-interest is no longer the economic interest, too. And the city changed. Attitude change, leadership change.
Oh, I mean, Allen's election was probably due to black votes anyway.
Right.
It had to change,
I suppose.
Send it
home. Before I left Irving, I was called by the executive. I can't think of his name now, but he left and became the executive of the Chamber of Commerce in one of the North Carolina cities, called and asked me for names of blacks who I would recommend it to the Chamber of Commerce. I gave him a long list of names. That was approximately 1960. The thing had begun to change. I recall once talking to Donald Child. I said, Mr. Child, who are you voting for? This was in the Preston of Georgia parking garage. He said, Bob, I'm going with who? You tell me who you vote for, and I tell you who I'm going for. We had come just that far, and that short period of time. Anything that I was concerned with at that time, I could always pick up the phone and call John O'Child. I could also pick up the phone and call Mr. John Sidney.
And they were willing to listen.
They listened.
They weren't willing to listen 10 years earlier.
Mr. Sidney listened. I tell you how I came to know him. I bought some stock in the Preston of Georgia. And it was $800 a share. And the board of directors had moved at a 10-to-1 split, which meant that I had 20 shares. Okay. And I, one day, I decided I would go to the stockholders meeting. I went to the stockholders meeting. I'm the only black there. Mississippi didn't warn me. He then became chairman of a group that was concerned with desegregation for the school in Georgia. And I got to meet his son, who's about 10 years younger than I am, James. And we have maintained this friendship over the years. Age Stern. I got to know these people in Tuscaloosa, Georgia, back
I suppose that they were at least flexible when it came time to make those decisions.
Mills Lane, I was on the board of Turnstile Pitts Home, and we needed some money. Mrs. Yates and I went to see him and asked for some money, and she said, well, we need $25,000. And he said, well, this is a trust in the George Field, that's for $1,000. My share is $5,000. Okay.
How much do you think all this would have come about if, let's say, if the white primary had still been in effect, the county unit system has still been in effect?
It would not have come about.
It would not have come about. Okay. That's what I thought. Yeah.
During the Waverly County, the South, I think it was the South case, wasn't it the South? Mark Haven was
involved. Mark Haven was involved in the case that night. Yeah.
Harold Fleming was secretary of the council at that time. Another wonderful guy. Harold Fleming is now a president of the Potomac Institute in Washington. And
what was his role?
Oh, he was head of the Southern Regional. He became head of Southern Regional Council after George Mitchell left. Then left here and went to Washington to head the Potomac Institute.
Okay. It was just one other. I want to get your thoughts on the. I've heard a lot about a spirit of compromise in Atlanta that it helped avoid any kind of big riots or disorders. And Atlanta became the civil rights center, I would say. And I was just curious, the fact that Atlanta became the civil rights center, did it have anything to do with this tradition of black-white communication which had been developed earlier? In other words, the desire to work out problems with nonviolent means and through compromise. Is this myth or
fact?
Okay, then there was sort of a tradition of whites and blacks sitting down together trying to work out their problems. And
you see, fortunately for Atlanta, what makes Atlanta so different from any other southern city or any other city in the United States? The colleges,
right? The leadership that comes out of that.
Right. Blacks, the black community, the black Atlanta, the bank, Atlanta Life, the saving loan, growing slowly, slowly, and they communicated with their counterparts in the bank. There had to be. So there was always this kind of communication on that level. And then when blacks began to flex their muscles economically and politically, there was more communication. And they sat down together. Many a deal was made in the offices of the Atlanta Urban League. Fortunately, when the Columbians and Ku Klux Klan were raging in the city of Atlanta, and they wanted to kick the Atlanta Urban League out of the community chest, as it was called at that time. Mm-hmm. It was Dick Rich who said to the power structure, if you kick the Urban League out, who's going to pick up the tab? Because they had contributed to housing, to falling hospitals, and they put out many a fire. Now who's going to pick up that tab?
This is the same Dick Rich who gave so much trouble about desegregating his own store, though.
Yes. But you see, that came later, the segregation. But I'm talking about the period now when we were threatened with being cut off from the community chest. Many other urban leagues throughout the Southeast were kicked out. Jacksonville, New Orleans, Richmond, name it, they're all cut out.
So it didn't happen here, you would say, because there was sort of a history of the two groups talking to each other.
That's right.
Do you think Martin Luther King Jr. was influenced by this at all? The fact that he was a leader of a nonviolent protest movement?
Martin Luther's father?
Yeah.
Not Jr. The old man was the Democrat in the voters' league. Walden was a Democrat.
Yeah.
Cochran was a Democrat.
Yeah.
Thompson was a Democrat. A lot of us. Now, the Republicans, Bill Shaw, Dobbs, et al., okay. But we came together because we were black.
Sure.
And they listened.
the lights system.
The light system.
Yeah, because I was just curious. Everybody always speaks about the influence of Gandhi on King, and I was wondering.
He may have.
You know, I just wonder if Atlanta had any influence on King.
They have a goddamn good effect on Martin Luther. Martin Luther King didn't stay here that much, but he was his father who made the groundwork.
But he must have gotten something out of his father too, in terms of style, in terms of working with whites.
He may have. You know, but Martin Luther King came to Atlanta from Dexter. Baxter Church and Montgomery.
But he grew up here, though. I mean,
yeah, but he didn't spend much time in it. Went to Morehouse and went to school at home.
Yeah, I would have liked to speak to King Jr., so too bad. Yeah.
I wish you could have met his father.
Yeah. Well, him and Benjamin Mays were two people I really would have loved to meet. It's just, you know, unfortunately, they died.
The great Benjamin Mays.
He seems to have a tremendous influence in so many ways in the community. Yeah.
Well, yes, particularly at Morehouse.
Well, you know, in terms of his influence among the leadership that came out of Morehouse too. And,
well, they admired him, but there are many people in the university who did not like me. They were damn dictators.
Oh, really? I heard that about King Sr. a little bit too, I suppose.
King Sr. so far as the church, but in the community, King Sr. was always a part of the community. Borders, on the other hand, was the same. But Borders was the builder. We helped him to get his first project through.
Right. East Street House.
Yeah, East Street Garden.
Right. Well, you know, it's, one of the things I really want to look at is why a city like Atlanta developed differently than a city like Birmingham, for example. Why we didn't have the problems here.
Leadership.
Black leadership, and what? White leadership?
White leadership.
Willing to talk. And what? Recognizing black power, too, right?
In 1955, I think it was, the Commission on Race and Housing, headed by the former president of Barrow Savings Bank in New York, Earl B. Spruce, head of the commission, funded by the Ford Foundation, to make a comparative study that you alluded to, a comparative study of Atlanta, Birmingham. Dr. Holland Lewis and I went into Birmingham, where we found, in talking to A.G. Gaston, that the White Savings and Loan Association and mortgage bankers in Birmingham protested the application of Gaston to have a savings and loan association. I said, A.G., where is the record? He said, you go and talk to Arthur Shores. I went to Shores' office, got the document and read it, and was dumbfounded to find that the white financial institutions, all of them, protested to Greensboro, the Federal Home Loan Bank Board at that time, who subsequently moved to Atlanta, Gaston having a savings and loan association. After reading the document, I said to Howland, he's going to fight. I picked up the phone and called Grace Hamilton. I called Dr. Ira Reed. I called Lester Granger in New York. The former president of the NAACP, Roy Wilkins. I said, this is what the story, what's happening. Do something about it. Grace Hamilton had a friend by the name of Francis Williams, who was on Senator Lehman's staff
in New York.
New York. Yeah. Senator Lehman, in the meantime, we called Chuck Bolte, head of the American Veterans Committee at that time.
Yeah.
And Washington was deluged with questions. Why are you denying this black man this thing? This was like January. At the same time, Arthur E. Lucy was trying to get into the University of Alabama.
This is what, now early 60s for years?
This,
well, 56, 59, 60?
This was, when we were over there, this was 55, 56, 55, 56. Okay. We came back to Atlanta. We still began to call and talk to people about the White Savings Loan Association, the bankers of mortgage, because the banks, over, the mortgage companies over there would lend banks money for 9, 10 years. No 20, no 30-year mortgages.
6 weeks later, I got a telephone call from the president of the Federal Home Loan Bank Board in Washington. Mm-hmm. Said, Mr. Thompson, we have approved the application of A.G. Gaston. They have until September the 1st to raise $1 million from 1,000 people. They got the message in Birmingham before I got it.
Mm-hmm.
The blacks in Birmingham pulled all of their money out of the banks and the casinos and this country in Birmingham. And by September the 1st, they had about $1.5 million.
So it was chartered?
It was chartered. Now, that same owner's association is larger than Mutual Federal here in Atlanta.
Yeah, but the thing is, I guess, the Atlanta one was started much earlier, so they didn't get that spark from the...
Ruth Alves was founded in that bank by 1921.
Yeah. Well, I think it's the importance of the insurance company here and the banks that really was able to, I guess, allow blacks to begin moving out to the West Side in the first place in terms of buying homes. And that really isn't true in a lot of other cities.
That's right.
And there's the leadership.
Yeah. See, Birmingham was an absentee ownership town.
Yeah. No, but, you know, just in terms of the violence that erupted in Birmingham, which you didn't see here, it seemed to me that the whites here were a little more, realistic about dealing with the black community. That
people, they're better educated. We got the colleges and universities here. We don't have that in Birmingham.
What, the whites were better educated? I know the blacks were better educated.
And the whites here, in my opinion, were more enlightened than the whites in Birmingham.
Oh, really? Okay.
The mentality is quite different. Industrial town,
yeah.
Absentee owned. Here, this is a white collar town.
Yeah. Plus, I guess Atlanta really been very touchy about its image, too.
It is.
Yeah. That seems to be a big factor. I see it all the time, reading the Chamber of Commerce stuff.
Yeah.
You know, we really would like to continue segregation in the schools, but boy, it's bad for our image in terms of violence here. So let's compromise.
Yeah. Or whatever.
Yeah, whatever. Yeah. Okay, I guess that covers me pretty well, pretty much. But what I wanted to speak to you about, If I have any more questions, do you mind if I call you some other time? And
I don't mind anything.
Yeah.
Because what you've done, past 3 years, I have had the opportunity and pleasure of talking to the group of kids in those Atlanta, the meetup at what's the lake up in North Atlanta? North Georgia. Arrowhead.
Oh, yeah, I know that.
Okay. And it's sponsored by one of the persons I know, Mrs. Davis,
mm-hmm.
He's city councilman.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. And Dr. Jane Browning. You know Dr. Browning?
I think so. Yeah.
She's president of, well, she's connected with this group, and she's also president of a group called Inroads Atlanta, an organization that attempts to place qualified, highly skilled blacks to keep jobs throughout the city and state.
Mm-hmm.
And I have thoroughly enjoyed that, and it's something that I had a liking. And what I was asked to do initially 3 years ago was to list blacks who made very, very valuable contributions in terms of expansion,
mm-hmm.
politics, and life.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you'll find in there a lot of names and persons. Did you happen to pick up the article that I wrote the file on?
I haven't seen that yet. I know about it.
I want to take a look at that.
There's still a lot of people I want to speak to. You know, I have a whole list of whites and blacks I want to get in touch with. In fact, I was supposed to get have an interview with Ivan Allen yesterday, but he took sick. And he's going to be commissioned for about 2 weeks. But I guess Grace Hamilton's the next one I want to speak to as well. Are there any papers that I could possibly borrow and get back to you at all?
Okay. Because I could, just take him for a few days and bring him back to your house. And, you know, it's no big trip for me, really.
I thought I had a copy of the original gift somewhere.